This is the Daily Radio Ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Luke. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in Luke chapter 23.
If your house has an older gas furnace, you're familiar with the pilot light. It's a standing flame that acts as a trigger for the bigger burner. Well, the pilot light stays perpetually lit. It's what ignites the furnace when you want to crank up the heat in the house. You can't fire up the furnace without the pilot. And the Jewish hierarchy knew that they couldn't kill Jesus without the pilot. Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor of Judea, was the trigger that had to be squeezed for Jesus to be crucified. In 19 AD, the Romans stripped the Jews of their right to exercise capital punishment. A death sentence could only be handed down by Rome and its agents. Thus, Pilate was the pilot light. Pontius Pilate was one of the most infamous villains in history. He ruled Judea for a decade, from 26 to 36 AD. He was the governor of Judea. For 1900 years, there was no archaeological proof that Pilate existed. That is until 1961. That's when archaeologists excavating the amphitheater of Caesarea discovered a limestone tablet engraved with his name. Those of you who've been with me to Caesarea have seen the replica that's on display. The original is tucked away safely in the Israeli Museum. Most of what we know about Pilate is from the Bible, but legends about him abound. One story says that he ended up overcome with guilt and committed suicide. There's another story. When the Caesar in Rome became ill, he sent word to Pilate hoping to see Jesus. He had heard of Jesus' miracles. Pilate stalled in answering Tiberius since he'd already crucified Jesus. A woman named Veronica had followed Jesus to the cross and had wiped his brow with her handkerchief. The cloth held a mysterious representation of the face of Jesus. Veronica went to Rome and presented the cloth to the emperor. He was miraculously healed, but he became furious at Governor Pilate. Thus, he had him executed. You could say Tiberius turned off the pilot. Well, verse 1 begins in Luke chapter 23. Then the whole multitude of them, that is the Jews, arose and led him, Jesus, to Pilate. Pilate was an enigma, really. He hated the Jews and their customs, but he often appeased their leaders to keep the peace. In fact, Pilate tried Jesus 3 times and acquitted him after each of these queries. And yet he still sentenced Jesus to death in order to placate the Jewish leaders. Pilate was the consummate politician. He cared more for posturing than for principle. He was more about the political ramifications than he was the spiritual consequences. Our text continues, and they, the Jewish leaders, began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." All 3 of their accusations violated Roman law. Of course, the first 2 were total fabrications. Jesus never did pervert the nation. And he did pay his taxes, once paying he and Peter's tax from a coin they found in a fish's mouth. Pilate knew that these first 2 accusations were bogus. But he probes into the 3rd charge. Then Pilate asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" He answered him and said, "It is as you say." Jesus did claim to be a king, but he never voiced his political or military ambition. Jesus was the king of a spiritual, eternal kingdom. He certainly posed no immediate threat to Pilate. And so Pilate said to the chief priests in the crowd, "I find no fault in this man." Verse 5. But they were the more fierce, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place." When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at the time. Again, Pilate plays the politician. He passes the buck. Herod Antipas was the ruler over the region of Galilee. He happened to be in town for the Passover, and so this became a matter for Herod to decide. Verse 8. Now when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, for he had desired for a long time to see him, because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. And understand, Herod had no real desire to follow Jesus. He just viewed him as a sideshow, sort of like a spiritual circus. He wanted to see a miracle. Then he questioned him with many words, but Jesus answered him nothing. Jesus said nothing, but in doing so, he spoke loudly. His silence fulfilled the messianic prophecy. Isaiah 53, verse 7, he was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shears is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Well, we're told, and the chief priests and scribes, they stood and vehemently accused him. Then Herod, with his men of war, treated him with contempt and mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him back to Pilate. God's son is being treated like a political football. Herod now punts him back to Pilate. That very day, Pilate and Herod became friends. Friends with each other, for previously they had been at enmity with each other. Isn't it amazing? Resistance to Jesus creates unlikely alliances. It unified two men who were otherwise rivals, Pilate and Herod. Well, then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, said to them, "You have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I find no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse him. No, neither did Herod either, for I sent him back to him, and indeed nothing deserving of death has been done by him. I will therefore chastise him and release him." In Pilate's eyes, Jesus had done nothing to deserve death. But here he tries to placate, to pacify the Jews by having Jesus scourged or beaten. This was typical Pilate politics. He ignores the truth and he tries to strike a compromise. We're told in verse 17, "For it was necessary for him to release one of them at the feast." Now apparently, the Roman governors in Judea had started a tradition. Passover was about freedom from bondage. And so to celebrate this freedom, the governor would set a Jewish prisoner free. Pilate was hoping to use this tradition as a loophole. He could release Jesus without calling the Jewish charges what they were, which was bogus. Well, we're told, and they all cried out at once, saying, "Away with this man and release to us Barabbas," who had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder. And I'm sure Pilate couldn't believe his ears. From all accounts, Barabbas was a terrorist. He was an enemy of both Rome and Jerusalem. You see, Barabbas' goal was insurrection. Upset the Romans by keeping the city on pins and needles. If innocent people died, then so be it. The Jews hated this outlaw as much as the Romans. Pilate thought, surely they'll never want Barabbas back on their streets. But on this day, none of Pilate's instincts were right. He underestimated the Jews' intense hatred for Jesus. And so we read in verse 20, "Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus, again called out to them, but they shouted, saying, 'Crucify him, crucify him.'" The Jews responsible for railroading Jesus were the chief priests. They were the rulers. Remember, this wasn't the same crowd that hailed Jesus their Messiah the previous Sunday. Most Jews were still waking up after their Thursday night Passover feast. Jesus' arrest and these phony trials were carried out in the early mornings, the wee hours of the morning. Well, then Pilate said to them the third time, "Why, what evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go." But they were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified. Never underestimate the intensity of a religious prejudice. Jesus was a threat to the whole religious system that had been construed and constructed by the Jews. And because he was a threat to their system, they wanted him eliminated. It's true today. Often Christianity's fiercest opposition comes from the religion, not from the state. But we're told, and the voices of these men and of the chief priests prevailed. Sadly, it wasn't truth and righteousness that prevailed that day. It was the loudest voices. And so Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they requested, and he released to them the one they requested, who for rebellion and murder had been thrown into prison, but he delivered Jesus to their will. In Matthew's account, at this point we're told, and I quote, "Then he released Barabbas to them, and when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified." Oh, this scourging was the chastisement that Pilate had threatened several times before. It was a savage beating. The Romans actually called it the halfway death. A cat of nine tails with little bits of lead and ivory embedded into the ends of the cords were used to churn the victim's back into hamburger. His internal organs ended up exposed. Often a rib or a bone would literally fly off the victim's body during the beating. At the conclusion of the ordeal, the body was cut down. When it hit the pavement, it usually landed in a puddle of blood and urine and feces and sweat. Many of the victims died during the scourging and never even made it to the cross. Those who were unfortunate enough to survive this scourging were made to then carry their own cross to the place of execution. And of course, this was the case with Jesus. Verse 26. "Now, as they led him away, they laid hold of a certain man, Simon, a Cyrenian, who was coming from the country, and on him they laid the cross that he might bear it after Jesus." Here was a man recruited from the crowd. Under Roman law, a soldier had the legal right to recruit a civilian to carry his armor. This inconvenienced the bystander. I mean, this was a burden for this particular man. You know, we're told that he was supposed to carry the Roman soldier's baggage for at least a Roman mile, 1 millennium, which was a little shorter than our 5,280 feet. This particular bystander was a man named Simon from Cyrene in North Africa. Here's a man that may have had black skin. He had made the Passover pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Perhaps Simon was on his way to the temple that morning when suddenly he stumbled across this awful procession. He stopped on the curb to observe the entourage when all of a sudden the point of a Roman spear pressed him in the back, called him into duty. Ironically, Simon had journeyed to Jerusalem to draw closer to God. Who could have imagined that he would draw this close to carry the Savior's own cross? There is evidence that suggests that Simon eventually became a believer, that this event had a profound effect on him. In Mark's gospel, which was directed to the Romans, Simon of Cyrene is further identified as the father of Rufus and Alexander. Apparently, these were men known to the church at Rome. When Paul writes to the Romans later, in Romans 16, verse 13, he greets Rufus and his mother as members of the church. It's likely that this was the same Rufus, the son of Simon, who was now a Christian. Hey, put all the pieces together, and we can assume that Simon was converted from this experience. He went home with a faith in Jesus. He led his family to Christ, and then even later, relocated to the city of Rome. It's interesting that there was another Simon who just hours earlier had boasted, "Lord, I am ready to go with you both to prison and to death." But now when this Simon is needed, he's nowhere to be found. This Simon of Cyrene now fills in. Verse 27, "And a great multitude of the people followed him, and women who also mourned and lamented him. But Jesus, turning to them, said, 'Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For indeed the days are coming in which they will say, Blessed are the barren, wombs that never bore, and breasts which never nursed.'" Now, these were not the women who had followed Jesus from Galilee. These were girls from Jerusalem. These were the daughters of Jerusalem. They felt it was their duty to weep and to wail, to stage a display of grief whenever the Romans might crucify a Jew. Jesus sensed that their eyes were filled with tears, but that they were crocodile tears. They should have been crying for himself, he says, themselves. They should have been crying for their own countrymen, the Jews. For again, Jesus sees into Jerusalem's future. In 70 AD, the Romans will crack down on the city with a vengeance. They'll come with brutality, merciless. And Jesus is saying here, if they do this to a man that they know is innocent, what do you think they'll do when you revolt and you engage in a real insurrection? Well, he tells them, then they will begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. In Revelation chapter 6, this is what Jews will say during the tumultuous time that we call the Great Tribulation. At the end of the age, God will rock this planet with cataclysmic upheaval, and the daughters of Jerusalem will wail again. They'll ask for the mountains to fall on them and for the hills to cover them. In the midst of Jesus' crucifixion, it's interesting that he was actually thinking of his second coming. He says, for if they do these things in the green wood, what will be done in the dry? As history tramps along, men's hearts grow harder. Jesus points out that in his day was relatively early in history. The world was still fresh and new. These things were done in the green wood. You'd expect the kind of rejection of God at the end of the age when civilizations were dry and combustible and ready to burn in the fires of judgment. But this is being done in a much earlier age. Verse 32. There were also two others, criminals, led with him to be put to death. Three crucifixions were on the Roman docket that day. This was fulfilled in accordance with Isaiah 53, verse 12. Where we're told Messiah would be numbered with the transgressors. And when they had come to a place called Calvary, Calvary is the English derivative of the Greek word cranium, from which we get our word cranium. Calvary was the name given to the outcropping of rock just outside the north wall of Jerusalem. The locals called it Skull Hill. It looked like a person's skull. In building the temple, King Herod had used this upper portion of Mount Moriah as the stone quarry. The result was a rock formation that looked like a human skull. You can still see Skull Hill today. Erosion has diminished the resemblance a bit, but the eyes, the nose, they're still discernible in the rock. Usually crucifixions were carried out by a roadway where as many local citizens as possible could witness the consequences of rebelling against Rome. It was a stern deterrent to the locals. A main thoroughfare from Jerusalem to Damascus ran by Skull Hill. Jesus was crucified beside this road, perhaps at the top of the hill or maybe even at the bottom, closer to the pedestrians passing by. We're told there they crucified him. In one short sentence, Luke sums up the most torturous form of execution ever devised. They crucified him. Lethal injection, the electric chair, even the firing squad or the guillotine or a hangman's noose were designed to make execution as quick and painless as possible. Crucifixion, on the other hand, was barbaric and inhumane and designed to drag out the torture. 7-inch iron spikes were driven into his hands and feet. The victim was then hoisted into the air on a beam, his body weight pressed down on the wounds. Every breath caused excruciating pain to ricochet throughout his body. Most victims suffered for days before they finally died. Often the vultures would arrive before death to start nibbling and feeding on the victim's flesh. The dignified Roman, Cicero, he said this, "The idea of the cross should never pass through the thoughts, eyes, or ears of Roman citizens." Hey, Roman citizens deserving of capital punishment were beheaded. They weren't crucified, not the citizens. Crucifixion was for non-Romans, for slaves and savages, for people on the outskirts of the empire. And also, crucified along with Jesus, we're told, were the criminals, one on the right hand and the other on the left. Reminds me of the old pastor who was in the hospital. He was lying on his deathbed. He only had a few days left to live. He kept crying out to the nurse, "Please, nurse, call my congressman and my senator so that I can die in peace." The nurse thought it a strange request, but she finally complied. Well, when the two politicians entered into the room, the pastor told one of them to stand on one side of his bed and the other to stand on the other side of his bed. He told the nurse, "Now I can die in peace." The nurse just had to ask him, said, "Pastor, what does having your congressman and your senator by your side have to do with you dying in peace?" The old pastor answered, "Nurse, now I can die like my Lord Jesus between two thieves." Well, actually, we know from Romans chapter 6, verse 8, the identity of one of those thieves was actually the apostle Paul's dad. You remember Paul wrote, "My old man was crucified with Christ." Just a joke. On the cross, Jesus made seven statements. Here, Luke mentions three. Jesus said to the repentant thief, "Today you will be with me in paradise." He turned over the care of his mother to the apostle John, "Woman, behold your son." And then he said to John, "Behold your mother." That's when the sky went black for 3 hours, during which Jesus cried out in anguish to his father, my God, why have you forsaken me?" His final three statements come at the end, and they come in a flurry. His first statement was preparation for the last two. When he cried out, "I thirst," it caused the soldiers to moisten his lips so he could utter his grand finale. That's when he makes the momentous statement, "It is finished." And then with a final last gasp, he breathes, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." But the final statement Jesus makes from the cross is here in verse 34. And then Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do." And this is truly amazing grace. Jesus shows compassion on the very people who are spitting in his face and pounding the nails into his flesh and screaming at the top of his lungs, "Crucify him, crucify him." Friends, here is the heart of God. From the Garden of Eden, man has rebelled against his Creator. Yet God keeps loving and reaching and wooing and longing for us to return. If these people had known the heart of God, if they could see what had made Jesus tick, it would have never come to this. They would have fallen on their faces with appreciation, with praise, with absolute surrender. Instead, here they're blinded by ignorance. We're told, "And then they divided his garments and cast lots." Apparently, Jesus wore an outer single-piece tunic. It was of some value, so rather than tear it into equal shares, the Roman soldiers attending his crucifixion simply gambled it away. Think of the irony. Here is God, and they shoot craps for his coat. This was another fulfillment, though, of prophecy, Psalm 22, verse 18. Well, then the people stood looking on, but even the rulers with them sneered, saying, "He saved others, let him save himself if he is the Christ, the chosen of God." The soldiers also mocked him, coming and offering him sour wine and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." What a sinister day. All the world's evil has rallied together against God. Angry taunts come from both religious Jews and secular Romans.
That concludes the teaching portion of today's broadcast with Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Join us next time as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through the Gospel of Luke. You can learn a great deal about Pastor Sandy by visiting the website. The web address is sandyadams.org. That's sandyadams.org. Simply click on the radio program option from the main menu. When you click on the radio program option at the website, you'll find today's message and many other messages from Pastor Sandy. You can download today's teaching, listen again, subscribe to the podcast, or browse the archive of messages. If you live in the Stone Mountain, Georgia area, or will be passing through, you can get directions and times of the services. Again, the website for all this information is sandyadams.org. We love hearing how God's Word touches the lives of His followers. So please log on to sandyadams.org and click on the Contact Us link and send us a note about how today's message has encouraged you. Your feedback helps us tremendously. Once again, you've been listening to the Daily Bible Teaching Program of Pastor Sandy Adams. Please tune in next time as we continue through the Gospel of Luke. That's next time on Sandy Adams Radio.